From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 2 years, we'll be ringing in not just a new year, but a new millennium. Some people are already preparing for apocalypse, others for the dawning of a new age. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Landis, director of the Center for Millennial Studies. He's been monitoring millennial fever. Also, another turbulent age, the teenage years. We talk with Michael Barson about his new book, Teenage Confidential. It's a history of how teenagers have been depicted in pop culture, from Andy Hardy movies to Rebel Without a Cause. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a box set of Charles Mingus's Complete Atlantic recordings from 1956 to 61. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Closing arguments continue today in the Oklahoma City bombing trial of Terry Nichols. Yesterday, prosecutors summarized their evidence, saying it proves Nichols conspired with Timothy McVeigh to blow up the federal building in April 1995, killing 168 people. From Denver, NPR's Wade Goodwin reports.
Beth Wilkinson began the prosecution's closing argument by unfolding a huge poster board, which served as a map of the evidence the government has against Nichols. At the top, it read, "Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh on the road to destruction." On one side was a picture of the federal building intact, on the other a photo of the destroyed building taken seconds after the explosion. In between the two photos were the eight major pieces of the prosecution's case. Wilkinson then spent the next 3 hours taking the jury on a compelling tour of their poster board. Defense lawyer Michael Tiger began his closing arguments attacking the credibility of the prosecution's witnesses, then moved on to assault the FBI crime lab. The defense team resumes their closing arguments this morning, and the case will go to the jury by the end of the day. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Denver.
Typhoon Paca has crashed into Guam, causing injuries and major damage. Officials say the storm smashed into the northern tip of the island with winds of 175 miles per hour. Reports say at least 20 people have been hurt, three of them when their homes collapsed on top of them. One reporter says power lines are down and hundreds of people are taking emergency shelter in schools. The chief United Nations weapons inspector has concluded talks with Iraqi officials. Richard Butler says he failed to convince the officials to open Saddam Hussein's presidential palaces to inspectors. The BBC's Raghi Omar reports.
Butler said he'd been told by the Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz that inspectors would never be allowed to search presidential compounds. He also said that in his eyes he'd been unable to define exactly what constituted such a compound. He said he told Iraqi officials that he thought this would be unacceptable to the UN Security Council. However, Aziz told him to tell the Security Council that Iraq would defend its position. Butler also made it plainly clear that he'd been given no new information on the difficult question of biological weapons. Butler will now travel to New York, where he will brief the UN Security Council on Thursday, when the Council will meet to hear his report on his talks with the Iraqis and then decide what to do next. Butler has said that he will be returning to Iraq for a further round of talks on January the 19th.
The BBC's Raghi Omar. Medical workers in Hong Kong have confirmed 6 cases of a deadly flu previously found only in birds. 2 people have died. The latest victims, toddlers related to another child who has the illness, are hospitalized in satisfactory condition. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 74 points. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is rallying on optimism about low inflation and stable interest rates. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
This morning's report on November consumer prices was weaker than expected, as inflation remained at its lowest level in a decade. That fact, coupled with the expected disinflationary effects of the Asian financial crisis, have investors betting that Fed policymakers will keep interest rates unchanged at today's meeting. The market is also being boosted by strength of the South Korean stock market, which rose for a third straight session overnight. The South Korean government has taken several positive steps to remedy its ailing economy, including the decision to let its currency float freely. Among the active issues is market bellwether General Electric, which is higher after the company expressed resolute optimism about earnings growth in the new year. I'm Doug Krisner.
The Commerce Department says housing starts were up 0.8% in November to their highest level in 9 months. The agency says strong demand kept builders very busy and mortgage rates remained low. Starts increased 41% in the Northeast and more than 9% in the West, but they dropped in the Midwest and in the South. RJR Nabisco says it's cutting nearly 3,000 jobs from its worldwide tobacco workforce. That's about 10% of those who make cigarettes. RJR says it wants to improve prospects for growth by cutting costs in less promising areas. Most of the cuts will come overseas, but nearly 400 job losses will be here in the United States. The move comes a week after the world's largest cigarette maker, Philip Morris, said that it would lay off 2,500 workers. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
Okay, having listened to it, we're going to do a few things again. The first thing is the beginning of the first graph of the Grant Green, and then we'll do a little of the Coltrane, but we'll get to that. Okay, now we go to the Coltrane. Since I already did the last paragraph twice, I think I won't redo that, but I'll do at least most of the rest of it. Coltrane, take two. John Coltrane was obviously I won't even tell you why I have to get up and down off the chair all the time, because we'll just let him think it's something more exotic than it actually is.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're just about 2 years and 2 weeks away from the end of the millennium. That number, 2000, is pretty potent. Some people are braced for doomsday, while others await the coming of the Messiah or the dawning of a new age. Cult groups, new age visions, and conspiracy theories are all flourishing. My guest is monitoring all the action. Richard Landis is the director of the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University. Landis is also a scholar of the millennial fever that surrounded the year 1000 and its predictions of plagues, famines, and apocalypse. The Center for Millennial Studies was formed 2 years ago with the mission of archiving all the manifestations of contemporary millennial fever.
My work indicates that one of the problems with identifying just what goes on at millennial moments is that they're so short-lived. And so what you end up with is, you know, a millennial prophecy, an apocalyptic prophecy, is something like a ticket to the Super Bowl. You know, before the game's played, it's worth a tremendous amount. It has a lot of power. But once the prophecy fails, the only way it's going to survive is by getting cleaned up. You got to get rid of the embarrassing stuff, maybe salvage some of the more interesting other stuff. But the actual, what I call the booster rocket of apocalyptic expectation, has to be sort of bleached out of the text in order for it to survive. So what the purpose of the center is to, as much as possible, get this harvest of apocalyptic materials that is cropping up in so many places now, and archive it before it either fades or gets transformed by the passage of time. These are, you know, millennialism is an episodic phenomenon. It's not it's long term in the sense that it's constantly reemerging, but when it emerges in public, it's for very brief and intense periods of time. So we want to archive that.
What do you think is the appeal in end-of-the-world thinking? And a lot of millennialists subscribe to that end-of-the-world thinking.
Yeah, well, I think psychologically speaking, there's something, there's a tremendous appeal to what you might call megalomania. If you believe that you were chosen to live at the end of time, that you are of the generation that is going to witness and maybe even participate in the final resolution of the cosmic battle between good and evil, you know, that's a pretty high place to be. And if you're really drawn into this, you know, the very way you brush your teeth in the morning has meaning. So psychologically, I think there's that dimension. And of course, you get not only megalomania, but paranoia. And it's a great way to project all of your sort of fantasies and so on. The second sense is a kind of sociological sense and is related. And for this, I use the work of James Scott, a book called Dominance and the Arts of Resistance, where he talks about public and private transcripts, or public and hidden transcripts. Public transcript is, you know, how you behave in public under normal circumstances. Hidden transcript is all the resentments that you have about having to smile when your boss makes a stupid joke and you really would like to tell him off, but you don't dare. Well, one of the ways that we inhibit ourselves publicly is we think about what the consequences of our behavior would be in the future, how the boss would retaliate if we were to say to his face, I just think that's tasteless and I think you're stupid. So when you enter apocalyptic time, all this future consequential concerns drop away and you become uninhibited. And so millennial moments are moments where you get a sort of bottom-up expression of the kinds of things that normally people don't dare say.
Let's look at some of the current religious millennial views, apocalyptic views. Let's start with Christianity. What is the rapture?
Okay, the rapture is this notion that there's going to be a seven-year period of terrible tribulation before the millennial kingdom. And therefore, God will choose those he wishes to spare this terrible thing because they are just people. He will literally bodily take them up into heaven. And that will be the sign. I mean, when people start disappearing, and the rapture people have, you know, very elaborate, almost tactile imaginary scenarios of how, you know, you're going to answer the door and there's nobody going to be there, or you're in a traffic jam and all of a sudden, you know, a third of the cars are empty. And in fact, we have a sticker we picked up. Somebody produced a bumper sticker that says, when the rapture comes, may I have your car? So there's this idea that, you know, these people, these chosen people, will be raptured by God into heaven, out of the physical universe. And then it's going to be 7 years of absolute horror. And in the middle of that period, the Antichrist will come. And literally anybody who's left is going to be damned, not so much because God has abandoned them, but because the temptation of evil in this period will be so great, it'll be so hard to resist evil that everybody who is still around is going to get sucked in by Antichrist and condemned because of that.
Are there particular Christian groups that believe in the rapture?
Oh, yeah. There are a wide range of groups that believe in the rapture. And, you know, all you have to do is go to what I call the Bible Belt in your cable television stations. There are a series of stations. You listen for more than 20 minutes and you'll get, generally, you'll get both rapture and apocalyptic material coming up. My favorite is Jack Van Impe, who is one of the few to specifically select 1999-2000 as the moment when all this happens. Others are slightly less explicit in their attachment to the date 2000, but I think that, you know, the pattern is one where 2000 is clearly a date of great importance.
Actually, I was just reading his homepage, which is linked. I got at it through your homepage.
Right.
You have a great millennial homepage with all kinds of links. And on Jack Van Impe's homepage, he has like a message to people. And his personal message includes this, that current international events reflect exactly the conditions and happenings predicted throughout the Bible for the last stage of this age. Millions need to be alerted to the fact that Jesus is coming, perhaps today. So it's imminent.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, there are tour groups who suggest that if you go to Jerusalem now, you could be there when Jesus returns. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I'm willing to predict as a historian, and this is based on my historical work, is that there are going to be a lot of people going to Jerusalem in the year 2000. And the Israelis right now, remember, the Israeli government is by and large profoundly secular. Think of these people as tourists. And the evidence suggests that a lot of them will not be tourists, but what I call millennial pilgrims. And that means that in some cases, they're going to go with one-way tickets. And not one-way tickets because they're trying to save money, but one-way tickets because buying a one-way ticket is an act of faith. It's a way of showing your faith.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Landis, and he is the director of the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University. Let's look at some Jewish millennial thinking. What are the groups within Judaism that subscribe to that? Are there any?
Well, there are plenty. You mean contemporarily or back then?
Well, contemporarily first.
Well, contemporarily, the two major groups that are millennial in Judaism right now are the Lubavitcher Rebbe's followers.
And this is a Hasidic group, an ultra-Orthodox group.
This is a Hasidic group, right. And in fact, their apocalyptic turn, if you will, dates back at least to the Rebbe before the one who just died, and is related to the Holocaust. And I think that there was a lot of apocalyptic thinking going on in the Holocaust that has been lost to us, because, again, it's one of these things that fades. And I think that probably far more Jews believed that they were living at the end of time during the Holocaust than, in a sense, the literature would suggest. That's just a hunch. I haven't looked into it, but I have spoken with people who confirm that. So the current Lubavitcher movement it's interesting because it's interwoven with the last secular millennial wave in the West, which was the 60s. And Lubavitch, the modern Lubavitch messianic movement dates from the late 60s and early 70s. And they, a number of them, really believed that the Rebbe would be the Messiah and would reveal himself as the Messiah and were terribly disappointed when he died. The second group that's very strongly apocalyptic right now are religious settler movement on the West Bank. This is a movement, there's a very good book by Avi Ravitsky about this. This is a movement that dates back to the origins of Zionism, which was secular, but which had one religious spokesman, a rabbi named Rav Kook. And his followers have moved more and more in the direction of millennialism or of apocalyptic messianism. And that dates back in particular to 1967 and the reunification of Jerusalem and the taking of the West Bank and these cities, holy cities like Hebron and so on. So that's a second one. And they have started to get violent. And we see that first with Baruch Goldstein's attack on the Muslims at the mosque and at the tomb of Abraham in Hebron, and also in the assassination of Rabin. And this is characteristic of one aspect that I think we need to pay a lot of attention to in millennialism, and that is when people are disappointed, when their scenario that they're so serenely confident in is disconfirmed by events, one of the things that they tend to do is get violent. That's something that we see now since Oslo. Oslo was, in a sense, you know, the thing that reversed what should have been the juggernaut of redemption for these Messianic Jews.
Now, what about the world of Islam? Is there a lot of Muslim faith in the apocalypse at the millennium?
Islam has a tradition that every 100 years can be, there are various ways of phrasing this. Either it's a moment of renewal, a moment of profound renewal, or, and I think that this is probably more likely a way to understand it before the 100-year marker comes as opposed to after, it's a moment when the hidden Mahdi, or the equivalent, if you will, of the second coming of Jesus, it will happen. And so if you go through Muslim history, you can literally pinpoint every 100-year marker as a period where some fairly remarkable things happen. I mean, this is what I call the geography of sacred time, which people in the State Department would do well to pay attention to. The last century marker for Islam was 1979, which was the year that Khomeini took over in Iran. And I think that you know, if you look at what happened in Tehran in that year with these millions of people gathering in the square protesting the government, and then the government would shoot them down, and then there'd be 40 days of mourning, and then there'd be another million people out in the square protesting the government, you have a good sense of the kind of collective power that a millennial belief can bring.
My guest is Richard Landis, director of the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Back with Richard Landis, director of the Center for Millennial Studies. What are some of the new age signs that the millennium will bring apocalypse?
Well, again, let me change that. The millennium will bring some kind of major transformation. Apocalypse is probably too intense and too religious a word. Yeah, that's one scenario.
Okay.
I think New Age is definitely millennial. I think that, you know, when it kicked off, at least the current version of New Age kicked off in the 60s, the Age of Aquarius was unquestionably, in my mind, millennial rhetoric, that you had a wave of people who, let's say, climaxed either at Woodstock or possibly the Chicago riots in 1968 or whatever. 68 was sort of the big millennial year back then. You had people who believed that the world was on the edge of a radical transformation and that the future would be unrecognizable, or the past would be would vanish, and there would be a really different way in which people dealt with each other, treated each other, and so on. So that's all millennial thinking, and I think New Age has never really given it up. It sort of went underground or went out of the public eye during the Big Chill, but I think there's plenty of evidence that it's coming back. I know there are lots of groups of it's unfair to call them 60s retreads, but, you know, lots of groups of people who are planning all sorts of big peace movements for the year 2000. And then again, New Age has picked 2012 is their date because there's a Mayan calendar that gives us information up to 2012. And then after 2012, it stops. And there are New Age thinkers who are taking that as a sign that this was a prediction from the Mayan, who are a native religion, that this will be the end point. So you get that. You know, you had the harmonic conversion several years ago and stuff. That's built into the New Age belief. And so you've got that. And then that hooks up with things like ecological concerns. There was a lot of apocalyptic rhetoric at Kyoto. Greenpeace uses apocalyptic rhetoric. Apocalyptic rhetoric is really valuable because it gets people motivated. If I tell you to go recycle your stuff and, you know, save your garbage or whatever, or make all these sacrifices for the sake of the earth, you know, if I say, well, because otherwise in 100 years the earth could be in trouble, that's not really going to motivate you. But if I say, you know, we don't do something in the next 5 years, the earth could choke on its fumes, then I might get your attention.
And do you find militia groups are using millennial thinking to support the bearing of arms?
Oh, yeah, unquestionably. I mean, you know, obviously something like Waco is, you know, you can't ask for a better combination of weapons and apocalyptic interpretations of the Bible and so on. The militia groups, in fact, the Center for Millennial Studies has attracted a number of people who come from studying right-wing militia groups who are not trained in apocalyptic scholarship at all, but who find more and more just how much of this kind of material is, in fact, apocalyptic, and are quite struck by it. And the work of Michael Barkin and of Paul Boyer and of Chip Berlay are all works that indicate just how powerfully apocalyptic the militia groups are.
Now, you are a medieval scholar, and one of the things you've studied intensively is the first millennium and what the movements were around that millennium and what happened afterwards when the apocalypse didn't happen, when no great change happened. What were some of the predictions right before the year 1000? What were people expecting?
Well, first of all, as we mentioned at the beginning of this interview, a lot of the documentation is lost. I mean, we just don't know what people were saying because there was no printing press. We have a much better idea of what was going on in Protestant apocalypticism because of the printing press. But by and large, there's nobody there who's really recording. For instance, we hear from Abbo of Fleury that the end of the world, that was a preacher preaching the end of the world somewhere in his youth, let's say around 970, and he said that in the year 1000, the Antichrist would be unleashed, and shortly thereafter would be the Last Judgment. Okay, so that's one scenario. It's what you might call the post-millennial scenario, which is the millennium has already been in progress. The reason that the world isn't perfect already is because it's an invisible millennium. That's Augustine's argument. And now we're coming to the end of the millennium predicted in Revelation. We're coming up to the release of Antichrist, and he will be defeated in the Battle of Armageddon, and then God will judge the quick and the dead, and the good will go to heaven and the bad will go to hell, and it'll be the end of the physical universe. Okay, the other version, which I think is the more radical and more, shall we say, consequential version, is a belief that we are on the verge of the transformation of this world, that is, that the people who dominate this world now, the people who are unjust, the people who are corrupted by power and who oppress the people who are powerless, are about to be punished by divine forces, and a new age is about to dawn on the earth. And that, I think, is a more consequential belief. And I personally, and again, I don't have a whole lot of evidence for this, although I think I have considerable evidence, if it's read correctly, I think that that was the widespread belief amongst the commoners as opposed to the elites. Again, we only have what the elites thought. There is no commoner. Nothing is written in the vernacular around this period. The only people who are leaving records are the clerics who are writing in Latin and so on.
You're very interested in what happens to the people who are disappointed that the millennium did not bring cataclysmic change. Mm-hmm. So what happens when we cross that threshold of the first millennium and cataclysmic change has not happened? Do you know anything about what happened to the millennialists?
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of things that are quite clear. First of all, and we know this from modern movements, nobody gave up. You know, people didn't say, oh, well, I guess we got it wrong, let's quit. For one thing, I think probably the next millennial date was 3.5 years later, and people interpreted 1000 as the unleashing of the forces of Antichrist, and then 3.5 years later, the good guys would take over. So you got to delay it 3.5 years. And I think that's where you get the 7 years of the tribulation, which is 3.5 years before the millennium plus 3.5 years after the millennium. You have your 7 years of tribulation. But the next big apocalyptic date that everybody settles on is the millennium of the Passion, 1033. And I'm willing to predict right now that Christians will redate after 2000 to 2033, and that we can expect another wave of Christian apocalyptic expectation and messianic hopes and so on around 2033.
Which is the anniversary of Christ, of Jesus' crucifixion.
Yeah, it's the bimillennium of the Passion, right?
I bet you're glad that you're alive to witness this period leading up to the millennium.
Well, you know, there's an old Chinese curse that says you should live in interesting times. And I think we definitely live in interesting times. And I think that there are various serious problems that could arise from disappointed millennialism. And I think that, you know, just to give one example, Christians tend to be philo-Semitic in pre-millennial moments, and they tend to get anti-Semitic in post-millennial moments. So I think that, you know, there are all sorts of things to worry about. There's a tremendous challenge right now to civil society that some of the more radical and more paranoid and more violent forms of millennial thinking can bring about. But I also think it's a moment of tremendous opportunity. And I certainly don't plan to stick my head in the sand and say, it's just a construct of the human imagination and of not great significance, and I'll sleep through the millennium and wake up and everything will be the same.
Richard Landis, is it premature to wish you a happy new year?
No, I think we should all be wishing ourselves a happy millennium.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Richard Landis directs the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, clean teens and dangerous delinquents. We talk with Michael Barson about the emergence of teen culture in America. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the new box set of Charles Mingus's Atlantic recordings. We're listening to a selection from it now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Hey, Pops, give me one of those crazy beers, will you, man?
Man, that was real cool, guy.
Ex-stadio.
That's fine. Old playing old. Oh, we got to get this beer off.
I know. Thank you, Pops.
Pop me, Dad.
I popped you, Dad. Hey, Pops, thumb me, will you, Daddy-o?
Come on.
That's it. Thumb me.
Now, give me some skin and... ooze it out.
Just nice.
Attaboy. Ooze it out.
Now, elbow us. Just elbow us. Pops, do you pick up on this jive, man?
What?
Do you pick up on this jive, this crazy music here, man? Did you dig the rebop?
What?
The rebop, Dad. The rebop.
He's a square, man. Don't you get this at all? Boy, you take the brew on the side on the time, and you take this bottle right to be able to drop the bow. And if you want to, you take the drink and all the bamboo, the bamboo, the beam, the bamboo, the bamboo, the bamboo, the bamboo, the bamboo,
young people, who can understand them? Obviously, not the adults in this movie, The Wild One, which starred Marlon Brando as the leader of a motorcycle gang. My guest, Michael Barson, is the author of Teenage Confidential, a new illustrated history of the American teenager, and the movies, records, books, and magazines for and about them. Barson is the author of previous books about B-movies and commie scare films. He says teen culture doesn't really begin until about 1940.
It's an interesting thing. Obviously, everyone went through the teen years since the beginning of time, or the beginning of humankind anyway. But those adolescent years, until fairly recently, I think everyone spent more or less as adults in waiting, or adults in training, if you will. For instance, with music, there was no special teen music until, I think, around the time of Frank Sinatra. And frankly, even Sinatra, when he began in the late 30s and into the early 40s, was singing songs that, although teenagers were his most passionate audience for them, they really are indistinguishable from the songs he kept doing throughout his life in terms of the topics and the themes of them. They were generalized for, you know, emotions and romantic experiences and loss and that sort of thing. But even there, where he was perhaps the first teen idol, his music wasn't strictly about teenagers. That all came later, really, in the 1950s.
You mentioned Sinatra and how that was, in some ways, the beginning of music for teenagers. World War II happening at a similar time to Sinatra's early success. What effect do you think that that had on the growth of a population called the teenager, of a culture called the teenager?
Well, I think that the advent of World War II is really what ignited teen culture. I think it had been In the smoldering stage through the late 30s and in 1940. And you could see with somebody like Sinatra, where he was a lightning rod for a teenage audience that was looking for a lightning rod, I think, that something was about to happen. Maybe it was the Depression that had allowed teenagers to spend more time together, perhaps parents weren't watching them as closely. But however it began, World War II just set it off, because once the dads went overseas to fight and the moms were called to work for the war effort and consequently left the home, it was like a Petri dish. You had this group of adolescents who suddenly had all this unsupervised time for the first time, really, in the history of adolescence. And I think that that, over the course of the 5 years that World War II took before we finished with it in 1945, by then the parents came back and they had this subculture in full force ready to greet them.
You have some terrific paperbacks from the 1950s that are kind of like teen exploitation books. Great titles like Rumble in the Housing Project, Go Man Go, The Young Wolves, Run Chico Run, The Thrill Kids, Play It Cool, Teenage Mafia, The Juvies. And, you know, so many of the covers of that period had a kind of tough-looking teenage girl with a really large chest and a really tight-fitting sweater and worn-out blue jeans cuffed, kind of standing with her hands on her hips maybe, and there'd be a bunch of kind of restless, thug-like looking male youths behind her, leering at her. Is that like a standard cover?
Well, this is the bad kid culture. Now, you know, I'm sure, because you, like me, must have begun in what I call the clean teen culture, where we only could hope and pray that someday we would be bad enough to be accepted into the other culture, the JD culture. But it never happened for me.
Were you a nice suburban boy or a nice city boy?
I was a nice suburban boy. Haverhill, Massachusetts had a population, probably still does, of 40,000. So it was big enough to have a big high school and, you know, stores and all that sort of thing, but small enough that we never really found out what the rest of the world was till we all left it, or at least those of us who did leave it.
Now, what was the allure of the tough teenager, the delinquent, to you as the nice kid growing up in the suburbs?
Well, I think that it's the word rebel. They were able to live out at least for a few hours a day, whether it was just even having the nerve to wear jeans to school. I wouldn't have been able to get out the front door with that on me. But just the idea that you were overtly presenting yourself as one of the rebels in the James Dean or Elvis image, and that meant not only that you looked totally different from adults, which was one of the main goals, but also that girls would be attracted to you, which was perhaps the main goal. Of course, only a certain kind of girl.
Right, who wouldn't be attracted to your father anyways, probably, right?
Or to me. I don't care about my father. To me. No, all we clean teens could attract was other clean teens, and that was no fun.
Well, this leads me to The Wild One, the 1954 film starring Marlon Brando as the head of a motorcycle gang that terrorizes a small town. I don't know if you, obviously you didn't see this film when you were young, you know, because it came out when you were two or three, but when did you first see this film and what impact did it have on you?
Well, actually, this one didn't have a special impact on me because although the biker culture and the rebels without a cause theme were right there and immortalized by Brando as no one else could do, it clearly wasn't about 13 or 14 or 15-year-olds. In fact, Brando was probably about 27 when he made this, and Lee Marvin was in it. He was probably in his 30s, I think. But, you know, I think it was the film that came out the next year, the Rebel Without a Cause, the Nicholas Ray movie with James Dean, that was the one that really was all teen-centric. It was told from the point of view of these alienated teens. James Dean moves to this town, so he's double alienated because he can't even get into the local teen culture being an outsider. Plus, he's completely alienated from his parents. And so he's doubly alienated. And that's something that I think has always been there for somebody going through the adolescent years, this profound sense of alienation. But when you have a whole culture to hang it on, and that means you've got your own music, you've got your own magazines, you've got your own clothes, your fashions, your hairstyles, it really helps instead of just, you know, closing the door to your room and turning out the lights and sobbing.
Yeah, and as you point out, The Wild One in 1954 with Brando helped create the black motorcycle jacket as an important, almost fetish item for biker culture and for teen culture in general, something to aspire to. And, you know, Rebel Without a Cause gave you that sense of, you know, alienation, though it didn't have a rock and roll soundtrack, you point out, but Blackbird Jungle did have one rock and roll record, and that was pretty kind of important in shaping teen culture, too. Talk a little bit about Blackbird Jungle and its use of Rock Around the Clock.
Well, Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and the Comets had actually been released in 1954, the same year as The Wild One, and it was a minor pop hit. But what, again, triggered everything a year later was the brilliant person at MGM, whoever it was, who decided to play that song under the titles of the film Blackbird Jungle as it opened with scenes of marauding high school thugs. I mean, these were really thugs, not just kids who were appropriating the badge of a biker and wearing a jacket, a black leather jacket, but these were, you know, criminals in training, basically. You had Vic Morrow, you had Sidney Poitier in one of his first roles as the kids, and the good guy was Glenn Ford, the high school teacher. I think he was an ex-Marine. He's got a crew cut. And he comes in to this urban, it's, you know, New York urban high school, which is just dilapidated, and the kids are ready for mayhem and through most of the movie commit mayhem until Glenn Ford tames them. So it's not teen-centric that way because really it was a little too much for most teens to really aspire to. I mean, you didn't want to be in a vocational industrial high school killing each other with switchblades, if you had any sense.
My guest is Michael Barson, co-author of the new book Teenage Confidential. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Barson, co-author of the new book Teenage Confidential, An Illustrated History of the American Teen. I guess it was after the success of films like Rebel Without a Cause and The Wild One, a whole bunch of teen exploitation films come onto the market. And then, you know, a little later you have a lot of rock and roll teen films coming out. What are some of your favorites of the teen exploitation films?
Well, I've always had a fond spot for Invasion of the Saucer Men from 1957, which was one of the many, many, many American international pictures that were made on a shoestring. They were usually made to be released two at a time, largely for the drive-in movie market. This is a perfect case of movies that were made that they knew no adult was going to see. I mean, this wasn't teens appropriating adult culture. This was pop culture for teenage consumption, period. And in Invasion of the Saucer Men, you have teenagers out in Lover's Lane somewhere, parking and smooching and everything, and these little green men with big heads and bug eyes and razor-like talons land, and you start committing mayhem, and it's up to the teenagers to overcome them and save the earth. And there's barely an adult in the entire picture. So in 70 minutes and for a budget of probably $35, it looked like. You have this, you know, really dumb thing, but it was fun because, again, it was teen-centric, and teenagers saving the world from aliens is even better than adults saving the world from them.
Do you think much about the fact that, for instance, your grandparents were never teenagers per se? That there's this whole sense of a part of life that they never would have experienced, and your parents kind of barely experienced it because the life of the teenager hadn't quite been established when your parents were young.
I think about it a lot, especially now, having just immersed myself for a year in this. You know, my grandparents, I'm sure from the age of 12, they were probably working. I know both of my grandfathers certainly were, and you know, one of them was working in a shoe shop his whole life practically. So, yeah, it is kind of poignant to think of that. And I guess I think my parents, you know, were perhaps just right there on the cusp of it. My father was a high school athlete. He had all these track records. And, you know, he probably was a popular guy, you know, sort of a big man on campus in the high school at the time. So I think they were in on some of the teen culture as it dawned in the early 40s.
You devote 2 pages of Teenage Confidential to what you describe as Toon Tragedies, Death by Adolescence. Tell me about these records and why you've singled them out to be showcased like this.
Well, I hate to sound like my parents, but, you know, they don't make them like they used to. And this is one thing that was in full bloom in the early 60s when I started listening to the radio. And I swear it just dried up and disappeared. And it was an entire genre of pop music. I won't even call it rock and roll because I'm not sure these songs really qualify as rock and roll. But you had things like Ray Peterson's Tell Laura I Love Her, and Mark Dinning's Teen Angel, and Patches by Dickie Lee, and Jody Reynolds doing Endless Sleep. And it all began right around 1959, 1960, and it went through right to, I guess the end point was the Shangri-Las with Leader of the Pack, where you get this little story which involves somebody getting killed. And it was done as kind of teen opera, I guess. And sometimes it was done for noble reasons. Tell Laura I Love Her. The narrator wants to get his girl a ring, and he doesn't have the money, so he enters a stock car race, and he gets killed in it. But before he dies, with his dying words, he asks somebody to pass on the message, Tell Laura I Love Her. Teen Angel, they're parking, and they're on railroad tracks, unfortunately for them, and they escape in time, but the girl runs back because her ring, for some reason, came off while they were parking, and she tries to retrieve it. The train hits her, and she becomes a teen angel. And, of course, Leader of the Pack, they're, you know, this is really the whole thing in a microcosm. You've got the girl who falls for this bad boy, but this very charismatic bad boy, and her parents break it up because he's a juvenile delinquent and not good enough for her. So in a peak, he roars off on his motorcycle, something I always wanted to do but have yet to try in 46 years of living. And it's a rainy night, and the bike spins out, and he gets killed, and I'll never forget him, the leader of the pack, she sings. The Shangri-Las, incidentally, were teenagers from Queens when they made all those great records. So they were one of the few teen idols that actually were still teens when they became teen idols.
Well, why don't we end with the Shangri-Las singing Leader of the Pack, one of the great death songs. And Michael Barson, thank you very much for talking with us about the history of the teenager in your new book, Teenage Confidential.
Thanks, Terry.
Michael Barson is the author with Stephen Heller of the new book Teenage Confidential, An Illustrated History of the American Teen.
Is she really going out with him?
Well, there she is. Let's ask her.
Betty, is that Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, it must be great riding with him. Is he picking you up after school today?
Mm-mm.
By the way, where'd you meet him?
I met him at the candy store. He turned around and smiled at me. You get the picture?
Yes, we see.
That's when I fell for
the leader of the pack. not a smile. He kissed me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. Whether he heard, I'll never know.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a Charles Mingus CD box set. This is Fresh Air. CD box sets have become popular holiday gift items, so we've asked our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, to choose a couple to review. Today he has a review of a box set of Charles Mingus's Atlantic recordings. Bassist and composer Charles Mingus had already made some fine records before he began recording for the Atlantic label in 1956. But the albums he made for that company over the next 6 years, including Pithecanthropus Erectus, Blues and Roots, and Oh Yeah, did as much as any recordings to establish Mingus's reputation. Kevin says it's still easy to hear One Reason Why. They're about as much fun as any records he ever made.
The Charles Mingus Quintet playing George Gershwin's A Foggy Day. Mingus portrayed himself in his autobiography and elsewhere as a man of turbulent passions. That's true, and they usually helped his music. But during that Atlantic period, Mingus coupled that intensity with a lightheartedness he didn't always show. There's a long taped interview with him, which makes up one of 6 CDs in the new Mingus box, Passions of a Man, the complete Atlantic recordings, 1956 to 61. In that interview, Mingus says, "Everybody that's creative is a ham." He said it after making the album Oh Yeah, where he sang and played piano in mock evangelical style. Mingus said he was serious when he used blues and gospel music, and the humor he brings to it doesn't undercut the experience. It enriches it with one more layer. He can be fervent and funny.
Don't talk about my Jesus. Don't preach on the Lord. Oh yeah, I know him.
Mingus loved voice-like horns and had excellent taste in saxophone players. The ones in this box include Jackie McLean, Eric Dolphy, Pepper Adams, Rosson Roland Kirk getting some of his first major exposure, and the great Texas blues man Booker Irvin. Often a pair of saxophones will blend in a thick, not quite unison line, as on the piece we just heard, Ecclesiastics. That practice looks ahead to how Ornette Coleman, John Carter, and others voiced wind instruments later. On a 1961 concert recording from Antibes, Mingus keeps combining and recombining three horns in foreground and background roles to give the illusion of a band bigger than a quintet. On drums, as always, is Danny Richmond, who Mingus taught to play from scratch. This is Wednesday Night Prayer Meeting. The soloist is Booker Irvin. Nobody whipped bands into fighting shape like Mingus. His ensembles are always crackling. Well, most always. Besides some undisputed classics, the Mingus Atlantic box has a session by vibist Teddy Charles, some of which sounds like it was recorded underwater, and a quaint relic of the beatnik era, the clown. That's narrated by Gene Shepherd, for good or ill, a granddaddy of all public radio storytellers. And then there's that full CD of Mingus talking, which seems excessive, but does reveal a lot about the man beside the music. It is odd that a 120-page booklet has no room for track timings or the order in which these pieces appeared on the original LPs, but does have room to plug the Mingus Big Band that plays in New York every week. It's great that people still play his tunes, and sometimes they sound very nice, but it's not like having the real Mingus among us. As a composer, he endures, but as a bassist pushing the band from behind, he's irreplaceable.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Charles Mingus' Passions of a Man, the complete Atlantic recordings, 1956 to 1961, on Rhino Records. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.